Welcome, everyone, to episode 27 of the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and our focus today is putting first things first in developing shared expectations. So this week, we are recording the Instructional Leadership Show live a little bit early. I will be in the air tomorrow during our regularly scheduled time. And I wanted to put some thoughts together for you based on some very in-depth conversations that I've had lately with several of our members who are at different stages of developing shared expectations, or what in my book I call instructional frameworks for their staff. So every week on the Instructional Leadership Show, we talk about some aspect of confidently getting into classrooms every day, having feedback conversations that change teacher practice, and discovering your best opportunities for school improvement. And one of the big components of getting on the same page, discovering those opportunities for improvement, having conversations that change teacher practice is around having shared, written, leveled expectations. We've been talking about that this month because that is stage four of our High Performance Instructional Leadership Roadmap. And the idea there is that when we're providing feedback, when we are having conversations with staff, we're not doing that randomly. We're not picking what our focus is at random, but we are very purposefully working from a set of shared expectations that we have developed and adopted together as a staff to put us all on the same page. We know it's not helpful for everyone to just completely do their own thing, but when it comes to being more specific, there are different levels of specificity, different places we can focus. And what I wanted to talk about today on the show is where to start. Based on where your school is right now, what is the best place to begin in developing shared expectations? Because I think it's different for every school. It's different based on the history of your school, based on the past work that you've done, based on the experience level of your staff, based on what your state has put in place and what your district has put in place. So I wanted to give you a couple of starting points or scenarios for choosing particular focus levels for developing those shared expectations or those instructional frameworks. So I came up with kind of a long list, and we'll go through each of these. You may have other types of shared expectations in mind that you are working from or working to develop, but I thought these would be some just kind of reasonable starting points for shared expectations. I found that a lot of schools, especially private schools and international schools, tend to have very little more than basic employee expectations around, you know, professional dress and showing up on time and, you know, just kind of the employee basics. And if none of that is in writing, that may be a good place to start. There may be some room for improvement there. A lot of schools, especially in the US, especially in states that got Race to the Top funding, have more elaborate teacher evaluation criteria, maybe from Charlotte Danielson or another author. I'll share three examples of teacher evaluation criteria. Maybe that's where your school needs to focus. And I was speaking with a principal in another country today who was kind of in the middle between these first two levels of focus, between basic employee expectations, you know, what does it mean to do your job responsibly so that you're, you know, a contributing member of your team, you know, the kind of basics of student engagement and making sure that that those fundamentals are in place, and starting to move toward that second deeper level of specificity about what teaching really looks like, and you know, getting those more leveled expectations. So we're kind of working on that project for that school. We're kind of in the middle of those first two. In other cases, it may be more helpful to focus on content standards for each subject and grade, the scope and sequence and pacing guides for each grade and subject, or maybe it's further down to the level of learning targets and success criteria. Okay, so we're getting kind of more specific as we go down from standards to scope and sequence and pacing all the way down to learning targets and success criteria. Or maybe you have a school-wide focus in mind that you are developing, that you've done professional development around, and you really want to see teachers deepening their practice in some specific area that's unique to your school. Or maybe your district has something along those lines that's been a district focus for a while. They want practice to deepen in a certain area. I think in the past I've given the example of a literacy initiative with thinking maps. I think if you go back to episode 26 of the Instructional Leadership Show, I gave an example from my time as a science teacher when my district had a big PD initiative around literacy and thinking maps. Or you may want to focus on team or department specific practices. And lately I've been talking about getting beyond generic feedback and providing feedback that's specific to the instructional purpose and the instructional activity that's going on in a particular lesson, and having teams and departments develop specific rubrics for those different common activities that they have in their subject or grade. So there are other options. There are other places we could develop shared expectations, and certainly there are all manner of different things that we could work on collaboratively, talking about norms or values. There are lots of other places we could focus. But when it comes to providing feedback, these are the areas that rose to the top for me as the most powerful, the most fruitful for developing shared written expectations. And some of these lend themselves to rubrics. Obviously, having a pacing guide is not a rubric, but it is a form of common expectation. So how can you decide where you should focus? And I want to thank our members who have spoken with me on the phone or Skype recently to talk about this. You know who you are, and I've very much enjoyed those conversations as part of our new Navigator program. Let's start at the top here, where really there's nothing in place at all. If your teacher evaluations have been basically satisfactory or unsatisfactory, and basically the teacher gets a contract next year or not, or maybe they're just at-will employees and it's just kind of been that way forever. I find this is often the case in small private schools. If you're in a church-affiliated school that's very small, things have been very family-like, there maybe really are not evaluation criteria in place. You may want to focus there, especially if you're having problems with a particular staff member. Like you might have someone who is chronically late and it's affecting everybody else. The class is not starting on time. Someone else has to cover the class because the person's chronically late. If there is nothing in writing about that, that would be a good place to focus because it makes your job easier. Whatever you have to do to respond to that problem is going to be easier to do if you have written expectations in place. If you have an evaluation form that is mostly a checklist and you're ready to take that kind of next step, this came up in our call today with one of our members who is in another country and kind of is developing everything on their own. Turning some of those expectations into an instructional rubric, for practice can be helpful if you take, the section on, attendance, punctuality, professional dress, grooming, and you kind of split that off from the section on instructional practice. You might not find it very helpful to develop a rubric for punctuality, but you will find it helpful to develop a rubric for things like student engagement, lesson planning. All those things that are covered in a rubric like Danielson are going to have some value in the specificity. So in making that transition, if you find, this will take us to our second point here. If you find that there really is not very much specificity about what good teaching looks like, that's when you want to start to develop that rubric. And especially if teacher evaluations have just not really been happening in your school, if that's just never been the practice, or if it has been the practice on paper, but not in practice, that may be a great place to focus, is really zooming in on those evaluation criteria, adopting them if they have never officially been adopted. If the history has just been, well, the principal evaluates everyone satisfactory or unsatisfactory, but there are really no criteria, I want to encourage you to take a look at the rubrics that are out there, because the thinking has been done for you. Like, decades of work have been done by some of our profession's leading thinkers. And I want to recommend three specific rubrics to you. Number one, I recommend the Danielson Group's Danielson Framework for Teaching. It's been around for over 20 years now. It's been revised heavily and used in the majority of U.S. states. I think most teachers in the United States, at least a plurality of teachers, are evaluated based on the Danielson rubric. And the advantage, especially for, say, a K-12 school, is that it covers all subjects and all grade levels. So the practices that are described in the Danielson framework really cover everything pretty well. Now, because of that, they're not especially specific about what instruction looks like. So there could be an opportunity to focus more on a particular aspect of instruction if you would like to. We'll talk about that in just a moment. So definitely check out danielsongroup.org. Kim Marshall also has some kind of open source rubrics that he has developed that I think are also excellent and very, very specific, and you're free to kind of modify them and build your own. You can find Kim Marshall's teacher evaluation rubrics and his principal evaluation rubric at marshallmemo.com. By the way, if you are a member of the Instructional Leadership Association, we buy you a subscription to the Marshall Memo, so you can get all of Kim's summaries of the latest research and news in education. We send that out every week with our Wednesday member update, so do check out the Marshall Memo. The third rubric that I want to recommend, if you do need to adopt or develop a teacher evaluation rubric, is the CEL Five Dimensions of Teaching and Learning rubric, which you can find at k-12leadership.org. And that is from the Center for Educational Leadership at the University of Washington. And I find that this one is not as well known outside of the Pacific Northwest, but it is very well done. And the Center for Educational Leadership has fabulous faculty, excellent capacity building resources, and on-site professional development. So if you're in kind of a small to mid-sized district and beginning this work, they're an excellent thinking partner in developing a teacher evaluation system. And I know many of the faculty there, really strong program and a strong rubric. So you can check out any of those three rubrics. What I would encourage you not to do if you are starting from scratch is to continue to work from scratch and develop everything on your own, because this is difficult work. Developing teacher evaluation rubrics that cover every subject, every grade level in a fair and even-handed way is extremely difficult. And again, the thinking has been done for you. So check out those three examples, Danielson, Marshall, and 5D. Maybe you're ready to get more specific with your shared expectations, though, and you're ready to zoom in to particular content standards. Now, again, you know, my thinking mostly comes from the K-12 public school world in the United States. And in most states, there are standards that have been adopted by, you know, by public schools. In some cases, those are the Common Core standards. In some cases, there are slight tweaks. And in some cases, they're totally different from the Common Core standards. You'll have to kind of see what's out there for your state. And if you have the autonomy to choose your own standards, I want to recommend a couple of resources that I'm sure most people have heard of these, but the Common Core standards are at corestandards.org. And of course, you don't have to be in the United States to use those. So if you are in an international school, if you're a private school, you're welcome, of course, to download those and adopt them in your school. I find that fewer people know about the Next Gen Science standards, which are at nextgenscience.org. You know, Common Core does not cover science, so I would highly recommend checking out the Next Gen Science standards, some very rigorous and ambitious and very well-crafted standards that you can access there. And for other subjects, I would love to know what you recommend, what your teachers look to as the source, you know, say for social studies, you know, whatever other subjects are taught in your school. I honestly have no idea what content standards are in place for PE or you know, many other subjects beyond ELA, math, and science. So let me know what you use. Ask your teachers what standards they are looking to, because I think we're in an era now where it's reasonable that we should all have standards, right? That we didn't just make up on our own, that we're developing these as a profession. It is a shared endeavor. It is a shared effort to build that knowledge across our profession. And I'm a big favor of not reinventing the wheel. Moving to a next level of specificity, if you're ready to go beyond standards and actually get into the scope and sequence and pacing of particular courses, that may be a great place to focus if everyone in your school is kind of doing their own thing. Right? If you have three ninth grade ELA teachers, and depending on which teacher you have, you might be doing completely different things in ninth grade English language arts, that would be a great place, a great opportunity, or a great sign that you need to focus on that alignment between scope, sequence, and pacing, so that no matter which teacher a student has, they get the same expectations, they get the same education, they read the same books, they do the same assignments. And I think there's a fear that squeezes out teacher autonomy, but I think teachers also understand in this day and age that it's crucial that we be aligned, that when students move on to 10th grade English, that I don't want my 10th grade English students to have had three totally different experiences and read totally different novels, and we have duplication and gaps. And, you know, I think that argument has been had in our profession. And yet, I'm mentioning, this is going to sound very, very basic to a lot of people who are listening to this. I'm mentioning this because all over the profession, we do have these huge gaps in our curriculum where we really don't know what we're teaching. We really haven't specified it. We've just left it up to individual teachers. And sometimes that works great. Sometimes teachers do a great job of coordinating with one another and creating vertical alignment and making sure that students have what they need to move on to the next level. But often they don't, or they do until the teacher leaves and is replaced by someone who hasn't, you know, had that experience or doesn't have the wherewithal to do that. So a couple of thoughts about scope, sequence, and pacing, depending on the size of your team. If you have a larger team, three or more teachers who teach the same subject, same grade level, you know, if you have three ninth grade English teachers, it's probably worth sitting down to get some intra-team alignment and say, okay, scope, sequence, and pacing. What are we doing in this subject? When are we doing it? What is, you know, what are the assignments and the major readings and the, you know, what are the major materials that we're using so that we can get on the same page about that and give kids a common experience. And from there, you may wish to work, do some vertical alignment work. But if you have a smaller team, if you have just one teacher who teaches each subject, or if you have maybe just two teachers per grade, it may feel a little bit silly to teachers to do that intra-team alignment, and it may feel more useful and productive to do vertical alignment and have teachers get together in different grade bands and say, okay, kindergarten through first grade, what are we going to do? First grade and second grade, you know, what's the vertical alignment like? So that we're not having duplication of content, that we are allowing the content to build on itself and spiral so that students don't have gaps and they're prepared for the next level. And ultimately, I think what should be the result of this is a curriculum guide, or a curriculum map, or a curriculum web. It should be easy to answer the question, what do you teach in this subject in this grade level? At the college level, we would expect that there is a syllabus for every course, right? You can go into any college class on the first day and get a syllabus, and that syllabus will tell you exactly what you are going to learn in that course, exactly which chapters you have to read by which date in class. And that's how the university knows what is being taught. That's how they create scope, sequence, and pacing, is through the syllabus. And of course, many high schools do that as well. But I find that it's a lot less common in middle schools, and especially at the elementary level, where teacher autonomy is looks different. Often there is nothing in writing saying what students are going to learn in a particular subject or grade. And that may have never been a problem. Maybe nobody has ever complained about that. But, you know, to me, it seems like a big opportunity for us to get on the same page and say, what do we really want to make sure students learn? How do we know if we are on track? You know, the work that teachers do in PLCs is all about deciding, you know, what do we want students to learn? How will we respond when they have not learned it yet, or when they already know it? You know, what are we going to do to move forward? Those PLC questions depend on having a scope and sequence and common pacing guide for a subject. And I want to encourage you to invest in getting that in writing. I do also want to encourage you to be realistic about what teachers have time for, though. I see so many schools that don't really have a curriculum, especially in subjects other than math, and they think teachers can just kind of make it up as they go, or pull from different resources that are available, or turn the standards into curriculum because the standards are very well fleshed out. Curriculum is not the same as standards, though, right? Curriculum is a lot of work to create. And I think there's a perception out there that teachers should be their own curriculum writers, like the teachers should develop their own curriculum. And I think anytime they have the opportunity to do so, that's great. The problem is time. Teachers simply do not have time to write curriculum from scratch as they're teaching. Now, Dr. Amy Bader of the Project-Based Learning Network is a full-time curriculum developer, and I see every day the time it takes to develop good curriculum. And if that's something that you're leaving to individuals to say, okay, well, you've got, you know, English 7, just figure it out. Just pull your own resources together, figure it out day by day, and then sit down with your team and develop common formative assessments. It may be premature to jump to the common formative assessments if there really is no curriculum in place. So we're talking today on the Instructional Leadership Show about putting first things first and about prioritizing where you first develop common expectations, shared expectations that get everyone on the same page. Curriculum is really crucial. Now, what's interesting, a little aside about math here. What's very interesting to me is that almost every school has adopted a very specific scope and sequence and pacing guide and set of instructional materials for math. You will almost never find a school that just says to teachers, you know, just kind of pull some stuff together. You know, you're an expert in this. Just kind of make it up as you go along. We don't do that in math because I think honestly, because people aren't interested in it in math. They just want to know, okay, what do I need to teach first? How does this concept relate to the next concept? And the amount of thinking that has to go into that scope and sequence planning for math is just so overwhelming that we trust our curriculum publishers. We trust our materials and we say, okay, this is unit one. We're going to do unit one. Then we're going to do unit two. And really the only decisions that we have to make about scope, sequence, and pacing are when, you know, the pacing decisions. We need to be done with unit one by the end of, you know, whenever, so that we don't fall behind, so that we finish everything that we need to. So think about math for a second. Think about the level of specificity and alignment that teachers have around math and ask yourself, do we have that same level of specificity and alignment in any other subject? I'm going to guess that almost universally the answer is no. For some reason, we're far more specific in math and we let ourselves off the hook for that level of alignment and specificity in our scope, sequence, and pacing in other subjects. I want to suggest that what works in math in terms of thinking through the order in which we teach specific topics, the alignment from class to class, you know, it doesn't matter which Algebra 1 teacher you have, you're going to be learning the same content in the same order because there are good reasons that it has been planned in that order. Why don't we do that in any other subject? Is it less effective? I don't know. Let me know what you think, but I think there's a big opportunity there to get people on the same page in terms of scope, sequence, and pacing. Now, moving on to the next option here, maybe people are in the same place in the curriculum. Maybe the curriculum is very well organized in terms of scope, sequence, and pacing. Maybe that one's been solved, but maybe you're getting very different results from class to class. And you think, well, this teacher's classes are doing great. This other teacher teaches exactly the same classes to different students. And it's totally different results. You know, like I'm not seeing the same level of rigor. They're supposedly on the same unit, but it looks nothing alike. They are getting very different results on our common formative assessments. What's going on here? Well, there is a very good chance that the gap is in the planning of learning targets and success criteria. That, you know, a lot of the rigor is designed in from the beginning. It's not about teaching technique in the moment. It's a planning issue. So it may be that learning targets and success criteria are the best place for your teams to focus. One book that I have been reading recently, and we also had Fisher and Fry appear as our roundtable guests earlier this year, this book, PLC Plus, Better Decisions and Greater Impact by Design. And just a fabulous book on developing professional learning communities that really look at, of course, what we want students to learn, but also how we're teaching it. So if that's kind of where you are, I would encourage you to check out the PLC Plus book. And I would also encourage you to check out Cassandra Erkin's books, Collaborative Common Assessments and Instructional Agility, both of which you can find on Principal Center Radio, and both of which we'll be discussing in an upcoming roundtable video conference for our Navigator members. Next up, what if you are wanting to work on something school-wide as a common expectation to build a cohesive culture and just say, this is the way we do things as our school. It's a unique point of pride. Maybe it solves a problem for our students. Maybe we have a lot of students who come from poverty and have a lot of trauma in their backgrounds. So we want to develop trauma-informed practices, okay? Or maybe it's something else. If you have a particular focus school-wide where you want to establish common practices to build a cohesive culture, that could be a great place to develop written shared expectations. And I would encourage you to not just give that a title and say, this year we're adopting trauma-informed practices. That's our big focus for the year. Don't stop at the title. The title is not specific enough. What I want to press you to do is develop a rubric that says, in particular areas, what does that look like? When ABC happens, you know, when this particular situation occurs, what do we do? What do different levels of performance in different subcomponents of that look like? Develop a rubric so that everybody is clear, so that you are clear as a leader, so that teachers are clear about what they're being expected to do. and get teachers involved in developing that rubric so that you can use it. You can use it in feedback, you can use it in goal setting conversations, so many places you can use rubrics about those school-wide practices. Now, I want to encourage you not to use this approach for whatever your pet practice is, your preferred kind of instructional strategy. And this is where I hear from a lot of frustrated principals, or I hear from people who work with frustrated principals who've been trying to get their staff to do more of something. So a couple of examples that you'll see on the slides here. If you're just listening to the MP3 podcast, you might want to download the slides, which we make available in our Instructional Leadership Association member dashboard. You might find that your principal, or maybe if you're the principal, you might have said things like, you know, I really want people to infuse more technology, or use more small group instruction, or use more brain-based strategies, or get students doing more projects and hands-on learning, or I want students to be answering higher order thinking questions, or I want teachers to be lecturing less. If you have kind of a, I want to see more of this, or I want to see less of that kind of expectation, I want to frame that for you in a slightly negative way as kind of a pet practice. Whenever we have something that we want as leaders that we want teachers to do either more or less of, I think we have to be careful not to just run around telling people, do more of this, do less of that, without an understanding of what was causing them to choose or not choose that particular practice already. And often what's missing is a school-wide framework in that particular area. For example, if you want to help students learn more, pay better attention, use more effective study skills, a great program for your middle school, especially maybe high school as well, is AVID, Achievement Via Individual Determination, or Advancement Via, I forget exactly what it stands for. I've been to the training, but it's been many years. And it's a great program for teaching kind of study skills and developing a culture of kind of self-discipline and learning-focused behaviors. So if students don't really know how to take notes, or you know, don't have a lot of those academic behaviors that you really want to see as they get ready for high school, AVID is a great program, but it's much more effective to have it as a school-wide program that's implemented intentionally rather than to just walk around to individual teachers and say, hey, I want to see you doing more of this and less of that. It doesn't work to just push your pet practice. You have to have a specific model. At the elementary level, a great model that I've seen used in many schools is Responsive Classroom. Responsive Classroom has terrific school-wide approaches. You know, the morning meeting idea, I think, is best popularized by Responsive Classroom. And they have very specific rubrics about what that looks like, very specific procedures for how you run a morning meeting. And you can get training for your staff on how to do that so that when you are giving feedback as a leader, you're not just telling people, hey, I did like this, I didn't like that. It's not random. It's very specifically tied to those shared expectations, those rubrics that Responsive Classroom provides. And again, don't reinvent the wheel. All right, what if you are working to implement shared expectations for district priorities? This is where you can push your district to be more specific, because often, again, the title becomes the only thing that sticks in people's heads, like, oh, we're doing differentiated instruction, or we're doing PLCs, or we're doing common collaborative assessments, or whatever. And people get that title in their head, but they don't really have a sense of what that means or what that looks like. So I want to encourage you, if you get the sense that your district is about to push a new, you know, a new district-wide priority like that, I want to encourage you to take the lead on that and say, you know what, we're going to be your pilot school. We're going to be the ones to go first with this, figure out what it looks like, what it means, how it works. You get to be the ones, if you sign up, you volunteer to be the guinea pig for your district, you get to develop some of those more specific criteria and rubrics, and you get to become the exemplar. Now, I saw this happen when I was a principal in Seattle Public Schools, when our elementaries were shifting toward the Teachers College Readers and Writers Workshop model. We had some schools that said, no, we're not doing that. And we had other schools that said, oh, hey, great, we're already doing that. Let us take the lead. Let us be the lab school. We'll train everybody, send people to us. We'll show them what it looks like. And those schools got incredible results and incredible autonomy to get those results in whatever way they thought was best, because they were willing to go first. So if you're worried that your district is going to push a model that does not feel like it's quite the right thing to you, take the lead on it and get a seat at the table so that you can shape that and develop that model on behalf of your district, because often district level decision makers don't have the specifics in mind. They have the big picture in mind, but they don't know what it's going to look like. And if you can lead them in that work, man, that's a great place to be in, right? When you are the exemplar and people are following your lead, that is a great position to be in. Now, the last example that I want to focus on is a level of specificity for developing instructional frameworks is team and department specific practices. And if you tuned in to last week's webinar or last week's episode of the Instructional Leadership Show, which was really a very in-depth webinar on getting beyond generic feedback and providing evidence-based feedback using specific rubrics for practice that I called team instructional frameworks. This can be incredibly fruitful for especially secondary schools and departments where you need to give people feedback in something that you have never personally taught. So this is actually what we will be walking you through the process of developing in our upcoming Instructional Framework Development Institute starting October 30th as part of our new Navigator program. So I want to welcome all of our new Navigator schools that have signed up for this school site license to our programs at the Principal Center. And the Instructional Framework Development Institute is kind of a bonus live program that I'm offering over the next couple of weeks. I will be teaching this live, how to pick the right people, how to pick the right focus area within each team. You know, what do we want to develop a rubric around? How do we turn that one focus area into a detailed, leveled rubric? And then how do we turn that rubric into an observation template where you go into the classroom with the repertoire app, you've got your template loaded in there, and it's cueing you about what specifically to look for. You've got your leveled rubric that's describing different levels of practice in great detail so that whatever you see, whatever evidence you gather, can then be aligned to that rubric. And you can say, okay, here is where we seem to be with this practice. How do we then move to the next level? That, I think, my friends, is where the power is in these rubrics, is that they create a roadmap for growth. They're not just, did you do it, yes or no? They're saying, here's where practice is, and here is the continuum of how good practice can be, because we've organized that into a leveled rubric. So if you are a Navigator school or an Instructional Leadership Directors Roundtable district, that program is included. And if you are a member of the Instructional Leadership Association, you should have an email from me with instructions on how you can upgrade to our Navigator membership level. And we also have registration open to the public. So if you are seeing this on Facebook and you're interested in becoming a Navigator school, now is the time to do that. Registration closes this Friday, October 25th, and we can get you a quote on a site license. Just reach out. You can email us at justin@principalcenter.com is my email, or you can go to principalcenter.com/navigator to learn more about that and what we're doing over the next couple of weeks. That is it for today. I'm Justin Bader, and this has been the Instructional Leadership Show, and I will see you next time. Take care.